You are listening to The Holistic Voice with your hosts, Austin Vitaliano and Jordan Reynolds.
Well, hey, Austin, how's it going?
It is going great, Jordan. It's really good to hear from you.
Yeah, I feel like it's been forever since we've had like an intro together, so that's pretty nice.
It has been a little bit of time, absolutely. What is happening in your life? What's going on?
So, big stuff. I'm moving to California, so I'm going to spend some time in Idaho with Danielle's family before we move to California, but I'm driving across the country on Tuesday, making it a big trip, going to Niagara Falls and Mount Rushmore and all sorts of fun stuff on the way down, so I'm pretty excited for that.
At least you're making a trip out of it.
Yeah.
Good for you. That's awesome. You're going to be able to see some great sights. So, I'm not moving. I am staying put in DC, having a little bit of a quiet summer. We're going to try to go exploring in the Shenandoah Valley a little bit. We're going to go hiking and do some fun stuff there, sightseeing, and then hopefully some kayaking on the Potomac. I am so still after our trip. I'm just so excited that, you know, you and I got to hang out at Classical Singer Convention about a month ago.
Yeah, it had been a minute since we'd seen each other, so...
Yeah, that was over a year of a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was really great because, even before the first episode, we hadn't been in the same room. So it was really great to just talk about the show, what's going next, plans for the future. Like, we've got some really cool stuff planned, starting with doing some more video type stuff. So really excited to get some of that stuff rolling and really great to get some interviews and talk to some people there at the convention that will be on future episodes. It was a really successful event, I think.
Yeah. It was a really good time. We had some good swag. We have some really cool stickers and shirts and everything like that. But I think it was the coolest thing to have students, parents, and faculty alike just come up and say that they had a need for this that really wasn't represented, not only at the in their everyday lives, but in their institutions and et cetera. So it was really cool. We had a little bit of a PowerPoint presentation lecture series that we were at too. So it was just all around, I thought it was a really, really great time. And one of the best parts was, drum roll please, our interview and guest for today's episode, right?
Yeah, so that was awesome. It's with Nathan Gunn. So we split this up into two episodes, part one and part two, because we were able to talk with him for so long. We were able to talk for about an hour, and we're trying to keep these episodes short, 30, 40 minutes.
For those of you who do know or don't know Nathan Gunn is a respected baritone artist and singing actor who's performed in many of opera and musical theater's greatest roles on many, many famous, prestigious stages. And he's collaborated with stars in musical theater like Mandy Patinkin, Kelly O'Hara, Audra McDonald, and he's done Billy Budd and Figaro and Joan. So he's a great, crossover artist and also the most down-to-earth guy you're ever going to meet. Super nice. And I have to share, I didn't tell you this, Jordan, because you were setting up, getting ready for the interview, but I met up with Nathan about an hour before our interview, getting all these schedules ready. And he's a busy guy. I mean, he was like the headliner for Classical Singer. And I go up to him and I'm like, hey, we're going to meet, just come with me and we'll go downstairs at the time that we're going to meet. He's like, oh, absolutely. So I go up to him at the hour and I say, okay, you ready to walk down with me? I'm thinking I'm knowing where I'm going. And I walk downstairs, have no idea where the room is. And I'm like, Nathan, can you just wait here for just 1 second? Oh yeah, sure, I'll sit down right here. I sprint upstairs, talk to Joe Isom, who coordinated this whole thing for Classical Singer, and she's like, you're on the wrong floor and you're on the wrong side of the building. So she shows me the map and I run back downstairs, and of course he's like covered with all these admiring fans that are like, oh my gosh, Nathan. So he's just chatting with them, and I go, hey, Nathan, we're just one floor down. He goes, oh, yeah, okay. But again, the nicest guy, totally down to earth, didn't even care. And we had a great, great conversation, I would say.
Yeah, it all happened so fast when we got the interview together. So I remember when you came down with Nathan, I was still setting things up, and we didn't even have chairs or the table or anything set up yet. And Nathan's like, oh, it doesn't matter. We'll just stand here for like an hour. We, you know, of course, we got some chairs and got that all figured out. But the fact that he was willing to stand for an hour interview, like, that he didn't have to do for this podcast, like, stand-up guy.
Literally could have been a stand-up guy for the whole hour. No, but...
I promise that wasn't intentional. That was awful.
Let's just dive right into part one.
Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So you just got in today to the Classical Singer Convention, right?
Yeah. First time here, and it's enjoyable. I love all the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed singers.
There's plenty of them.
There are plenty of them, and have run into some colleagues of mine that have moved into the teaching world, and it's great to see them, you know? So, yeah.
Did you work with high school students today, or college students, or what is it today?
I think they were two high school, maybe one, either going into college or college.
Sure.
In a master class. I mean, when we do classes, we're used to having a little bit more time. They say give us 10-minute segments.
Yeah.
And so we just ignored that. Yeah, but it meant we only worked with three kids. Okay. But that's okay. Master classes are more about getting some of that information out. It's not going to change anybody's singing life because you don't have enough time with them. But at least you can maybe change the way they look at something and say, oh, okay, I hadn't thought of it that way. This seems to make sense.
If you could have eyes in the back of your head, you should see the amount of giggling, nervous kids before they came to meet you.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you. So I've done a couple of things with Sting. You know who Sting is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. See, that's what I assume, right? So he's in. We were doing what's one thing together, and I was in town, and it was before he put out his musical, and he's like, what say you, Meg? He'd written. He's like, Nathan, will you come and do this demo? I'm like, yeah, sure, of course, I'll stay an extra day. And so I called home to say I was staying extra day to do this thing for him. And I talked to one of my kids, and they're like, okay, I'll tell Mom. And Julie, my wife, says later, she's like, so the kid said, Dad called. He's going to stay in New York an extra day, and he seemed pretty excited about this. He's doing something for some guy named Sting. I mean, I know he's excited, but who's that? I'm like, oh, God. Okay.
You're old. You're officially old now.
Yeah, right.
Gosh. Well, that's it's just really exciting how everybody was kind of anticipating. I mean, a lot of these teachers, like you were saying, they're also in the big performance careers, and now they're coming to teach, and everybody's excited to see them and have these classes, able to work with them, even just have a contact with them for a couple minutes at a time. But you're here now, and we're so excited. Thank you to Joe Isom from Classical Singer Convention for having this room for us to talk in and ability to chat with you for a little bit. But why don't we start from the beginning? I mean,
sure.
What got you interested in music, in singing classical music and cross-genre music? Why don't we start from the beginning?
Well, I always, as a boy, I always had a pretty voice. And so I sang in, my mother sang, just for fun. So I sang in church choir, and I sang it in the choir at school, in grade school, in middle school, and it was, it was kind of an afterthought. I was asked to be involved in the musicals at schools, and so I'd audition. I'd always get something, mm-hmm. but I never really thought much about it past that. Memorizing came pretty easy to me, so that was also not an issue, and it was something fun to do after school. But the other thing I was always involved in, besides just studies, were sports. I enjoyed them. I played a lot of sports from a young age.
What'd you play?
Well, I was a bit of a hyper kid, I guess. So my parents put me in a martial arts academy when I was four. So I did that 6 days a week.
Jeez.
I started then and kind of continued. But then I played football and then tennis, soccer, wrestled, basketball wasn't really my thing, but I did all those sports on the swim team. Anyway, it gave me a pretty good idea about what a good coach was.
You said you're continuing with martial arts? Is that something you're still
doing? I don't do it
working?
As much anymore. I've gone through all the, because in those days, like my teacher was South Korean. And apparently, I knew what he was talking. I guess you could pick up language pretty easily when you're young, right? But I don't speak Korean. But apparently, I understood what he was saying in those days.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
So, and then went through that to some Japanese style, did Aikido, a little bit of Krav Maga at one point, and then boxed. My grandfather was a Golden Gloves boxer. So.
Whoa.
Anyway, it was, you know, all that sort of stuff helped me, what I'm trying to get at, is have a pretty good kinesthetic awareness. And then I continued to be asked to sing. So I sang in musicals in high school, and at one point my mother said to me, you know, now you have a car, you could probably in the summertime sing at wedding ceremonies and Lord's Prayer or something and make a little extra money. So she got me a voice lesson with a guy who taught locally in South Bend, Indiana, where I grew up.
Okay.
And he ran a little opera workshop at the local branch of Indiana University, and he asked me if I'd sing Papageno from the Magic Flute. And I said, what's a Papageno? And what's this Mozart stuff? And he gave me a recording of it, and it was, you know, from the first chords of that overture, I knew this was something special. So I started doing that, I got involved in it, and I thought, well, I'll audition for some schools. And I auditioned for all the major conservatories and music schools, including the University of Illinois, where I now am a professor, because my father went there, my grandfather went there. Anyway, I got into all of them, and then I decided to go to the University of Illinois for, you know, obvious reasons. And it was the best thing I could have done. I found a terrific teacher, and at the same time, he was retired, so I wasn't I was a music major, but I was a Bachelor of Arts with a, what was, I think they call it an open studies major, so I focused on German art song, because John Wustman, who would be known, he played for Pavarotti, Regine Crespin, Birger Nilsson, all those types in that era, wanted to perform all of Franz Schubert's songs over a six-year period, and there's 630-some songs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So my undergraduate education was basically singing Schubert Lieder. So after my freshman year, I went to Germany and studied at the Goethe Institute, so I'd have some sort of hang of German. How do you memorize this stuff if you don't understand language, right? So I did that, and then the rest of my undergraduate schooling was learning how to sing and singing beautiful songs with beautiful poems, transposing them into whatever key was necessary for me at my level at that time. Sang a couple of bit parts in the operas that were going on at school, but it was primarily art song.
You do any cycles when you were in your undergrad, or was that too?
Yeah, my senior recital was Die Schöne Möller.
Wow.
I know, right?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and Jeez. Then for John Wustman's 80th birthday, I came back and we did Müllerin in the afternoon and then Winterreise at night. Yeah, I know, right?
Just for fun. Yeah, just doing a little bit of that.
A little bit of light singing.
A little bit of light, yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit of suicidal singing for you.
Suicide to craziness. So, anyway, it was, you know, these 35, 40 minute long epic things like, you know, Der Taucher and Die Burgschaft and all this sort of stuff to these cycles. It was really an amazing education. Anyway, so senior year again, you know, comes around. I tried to sing some competitions, and I won. No, I didn't. I got third place in a competition in Indianapolis. And in talking to the judges afterwards, this all makes sense. It seems like it's a long-winded story, but it's not. In talking to the judges, one of the judges said, you know, I really thought you should have won, but, you know, you should sing our competition. And that was Gail Robinson, who ran the Metropolitan Opera Young Artist Program. So I sang the National Council auditions, won the Met competition. They asked me to be in the Young Artist Program in New York, and that's how I got into opera.
Got it. So it just all came easy to you,
didn't it? Yeah, right. I know. Right. So, but I was an anomaly, you know, because I was really focused on song.
Sure.
And they were like, well, maybe he won't sing at the Met. Maybe he will. I don't know. So it was really at the Met and watching what they do and observing all these, you know, this kind of art form that I thought, okay, this is interesting. I like the Mozart. I like the Britten. You know, some of the Rossinis. You know, I still think Barbara Seville's funny. You know, and I really like new pieces. What I realized from learning about all of Franz Schubert's songs was that Schubert never would be thrilled if we were doing his music right now. He was a complete loser in his own mind in those days. And you know, and those people like Mozart and others were human beings. You know, they and knowing the composers that are composing now and seeing how they work and their the things that inspire them, the things that, the way that they sculpt a piece, their you know what makes them confident and what makes them self-conscious, all that kind of business, helped feed my understanding of what it was like for the people we hold on a pedestal, like the Beethovens and the Mozarts and the Schuberts and the Mendelssohns and the Britons and the Brahms and all that. They were people who wrote these pieces and changed them depending, because you get this idea that, oh, it's done, it's a born product and it's perfect, and we as classical singers, our job is to make what is on that page exactly like what's on that page, right? I've never thought that was a possibility. I think everybody's gut instinct is that it's not going to be perfect. What is perfection anyway? We're not typewriters, right? So we breathe, you know, what's on the page is not music. It's like, you know, it's like a recipe to a meal. It's not the meal, it's the recipe.
Exactly. Right? No, you know? Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you know, so the art song, musical theater was sort of something I always heard growing up and did a little bit in high school. And then, and it turns out that all that classic musical theater rep is perfect for my voice. I mean, when I sang Billy Bigelow the first time, I'm like, I don't even have to work on this. It was like they wrote it for me. And my grandfather was that character. Didn't do the same things, but basically was that kind of man, you know. And
so when you were at the Met and when you were working a lot of this very traditional classic rep, and you knew that you loved art song and you were growing, you know, into musical theater as well, how did you reconcile? You did a lot of that rep there, and then did you always have that burning sensation?
It was. I mean, the first obstacle was really, Julie, my wife, is a pianist, and we'd always worked together, but there was a little reticence in the business to have her play for my recitals and recordings. And she ended up kind of having to last minute for my Carnegie Hall debut, which was great because she stepped up to the plate. A lot of the pieces were, you know, in keys that weren't written out, so she could transpose anything. So she, you know, played it transposed and got a review that was a serious review about her as an artist, not her as my wife or me as her husband. Mm-hmm. And we realized, okay, so this is cool. And then after, okay, so people in the business say, well, you really can't, this is a very special venue, you have to do what they've always traditionally done. I'm like, oh, well, okay, we'll kind of do a little bit lame version of what we want to do to placate everybody. And then eventually what happened was, is, you know, up until even the recital we did at Wigmore Hall last month, they've never had anything like that ever. It was everything from things like, it was all American music, but everything from some John Musto and some traditional American songs to
Gene Shear.
Okay. You know, yeah. I mean, it was stuff that they've never heard there. But really, what I thought was the audience that is going to come to hear this, I know. And I know that they live in the 21st century and that they're interested in what I have to say and what Julie has to say and in what these composers had to say. We don't have to do what's always been done. And so that's what we did. And you know, being able to be honest and be us, I think it was the first time I've even ever, well, first of all, the response was great. It was a real sort of simpatico thing going on between us and the audience, but I think it was the first time the review has ever got it right. They're like, it just, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, well, we kind of forgot that it was about, that there was singing going on. It was just sort of a communication and a story between, you know, the guns and us, and it flew by, and it was just a wonderful feeling of human interaction, and we're like, that's what it's supposed to be about. You know,
yeah.
And so, you know, it's a process, and eventually, I think you get to the point where, in my situation, I've, what's that old mafia thing? I made my bones, right? You know, I can sing your standard rep as good as the next guy. I can sing the hard, musically, theoretically difficult stuff just like anyone else. But now I get to sort of put my stamp on it. I get to be my own, you know, Picasso of sorts.
So you paid your dues, and now you're free to do what?
Yeah,
do what you
I
want
mean,
to do.
Yep. I mean, and there's an element of, well, if Picasso could never actually do a true likeness of somebody, you kind of wonder about his other stuff that was coming out of him. But now I'm, you know, like this new piece that BMP is producing, and it's called In Our Daughter's Eyes, and Du Yun is the composer, Pulitzer Prize-winning, awesome composer, quirky, her own voice, and some of the things that I'm going to be doing in there take a real vocal skill, because you have to kind of get it right, but it doesn't sound like how I would get Rossini right. It's like, okay, on this note, you're so emotional, you got to crack into falsetto. Like, no, that's too soon. A little bit late, you know, it's like that. So you're like, all right, I'll do it. I don't, you know, this is going to be really low and close mic'd, and you're going to get lower, you know. And I just think, great, I see what you're going for. Let's give it a shot. And, but it takes 25 years of doing all the other stuff to be able to, I think, have the confidence to do that.
Is that something at the University of Illinois that y'all are working on, is contemporary works?
Yeah, well, part of what we do is workshop a lot of new pieces. The thing that won the Pulitzer this year, Prism, we workshopped. So, yeah, and we're finding partners in the education world. I think ASU and Boulder, University of Maryland, that want to do this similar thing. And, you know, when you try to, we have the capacity and the organization to be able to help with some of these new pieces, but in coordination with these other universities, we can do the two piano vocal thing, right? They can do the orchestral thing. Someone else can do the staging workshop, technical stuff. And then by the time it actually is presented, like Prism was, in LA and then in New York, it's had a chance for the composers to go, that chorus thing is just not going to work. This is too big. And it can be, it can get its previews, essentially. And they have a fighting chance to be successful. And because it's a university, it's cost effective. They can do this. And I think by, you know, this coordinated effort between us and some other schools, Manus is another one that's doing this now. And hopefully Manhattan School, we'll see about that. Now that we can do that, I think we can actually find a nice cooperation between the professional world and the education world to allow these things to thrive without it just being prohibitively expensive. Or, you know, one of the big opera houses throwing a couple $1 million at a new production of something that gets 6 performances, and they go, see, we care about new music, right?
Yeah, that's what they're doing now.
It's been that way forever. And, you know, and it's, they're going to hate this, but I kind of wonder, should they really be 501c3s? Just because...
Because of the way that they're marketing these things?
Well, I mean, is Faust being done for the 55th time for a small group of people that really want to hear it? Is that really a charitable thing? I don't think so, right?
Revealing the Mysteries with Nathan Gunn.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like, I don't know. And then there, you know, but there's new ways of thinking about this stuff where and of course, for the arts to survive, you have to really think clearly. But, you know, my daughter had an internship with America for the Arts, and she was saying, you know, maybe somebody should be represented here that is from the Midwest. And they're like, why? It's just the coast that matter. And I'm like, well, Minneapolis has, you know, the per capita, they spend the same amount of the same number of arts organizations that New York does. What about Chicago? You heard the views of some of the things happening in Chicago right now? I mean, it's that narrow, and I just kind of wonder, with some, you know, young people saying, well, can't we make something that's for-profit, something that people want to go to that maybe is an hour long, and then young people show up, and it's not so big you can't see everybody, and maybe we could listen to this new, you know, Akhenaten, for instance. That was one awesome piece of music. Maybe if we get the right kind of Meyer speakers, it could be a surround sound experience, like you got your headphones on and you're watching this, and not be so scared of saying, yes, we'll use technology so that all the singers can have a monitor to see everybody and we can project stuff, but we will not amplify, right? Isn't amplification having a wood set behind you? Why not use modern technology? Anyway, those sorts of thoughts are things that we think about at Illinois and other schools are thinking about. And it's all coming from people who've been in the business who say, look, Mozart in the 5,000-seat house is not Mozart anymore than not ampli- I mean, it makes as much sense as not amplifying makes sense. And so...
And it goes back to you as a singer individually, what you were talking about, how you find your own self.
Yeah.
The way that these characters were made 200, 300 years ago, people expecting them to have the same kind of personality, or you know, every singer brings a different touch, different taste to what they're doing, and so it has to evolve. The singers have to evolve. The houses have to evolve.
Well, you know, people were being trained as musicians back in Mozart's time to be a court composer. What are they being trained to do now? Be a, you know, to educate, maybe, to possibly be kind of a curator of a museum of music, maybe. One thing that is certain is that it's hard to communicate to people if we don't communicate in a way that their world has raised them. And as a, you know, in the sense that we are used to screens, we're used to technology, we're used to amplification, we're used to all sorts of cool stuff, right? So when you do Giovanni, great piece of music, should be done. Maybe we don't know what a nobleman is, right? But we do know what a corporate raider is. We do know, right?
Yeah.
Is that person out? Because there's the underlying truth that is the same. It was told in that way for them to describe a kind of moral turpitude or a questionable, what is really happening here, you know? We have all the same stuff. We might just not describe it in the same way. Because it's a slightly different experience.
I find this really interesting, this idea of amplification, using that in operatic works and things. So with that, like, where's the line of, like, when does it become musical theater and when is it opera?
That's a good question. I think that line has been sort of truly blurry for a long time. I think people have asked that quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, American musical theater really is Verismo operetta. That's what it was, right? It took serious stories and added it to musical theater. They talk about it in baritones and bound.
Yeah,
right?
They do.
Some, yeah. You know, and opera, it just means work. And if you take Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppea and then you compare it to Moby Dick or something from the Ring cycle or a Verdi, you know, Verismo opera. We call them all opera, but they're nothing alike, you know? They don't even use similar instruments. I remember doing Ottone for the first time when I was in London. I went to the British Library, and I got to look at some original manuscript of that thing. It's a lead sheet. They don't know, one, they don't know who really wrote it, and they have no idea what the instrumentation is, which tells me it can be whatever we want, right? So they used whatever was available. Yeah. Even doing Giovanni in Vienna the last time I did it, we had to do some of the orchestral rehearsals in Salzburg, and we didn't have a pianoforte, so we used a harpsichord, and I thought, that's exactly what they did then. It was too much of a pain to move the instrument, so they would use whatever was available. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of practicalities, I've always had a sneaking suspicion that the era of bel canto singing was at a time when most people sounded disgusting, right? They were probably sick all the time. Rarely did you hear a nice sound coming out of a human being, and you went to the theater once, there was no radio, no record player, no recordings, and somebody made this incredibly beautiful sound. And they're like, oh, bel canto, a bel canto. Now we hear bel canto constantly.
Yeah, that's
right?
The thing. Yeah,
I mean, it happens all the time. So, you know, I try to add a little bit of just realism to what it was like, you know. I think about Beethoven and his genius, and I'm like, well, the guy was, they think, deaf much younger than we believe. So he wasn't listening to the music around him. He heard it in his head. That's why his music is so genius, right? He came up, he wasn't being influenced by anything else. It's just what he heard. Maybe that's part of it. Anyway, they're really, my point is they're really practical reasons for, you know, why, you know, why things were done the way they were done, why the halls were the size that they were, why amplification was like they had it. I think if Mozart had speakers and microphones, he would have used them.
Yeah.
Synthesizers.
Yep. Yeah.
If
for
he could have
sure.
used holograms or VR or AR, he'd have been there. Yeah. And, you know, the Romans improved the Greeks by adding water in front of their things for added amplification. Why don't we?
Evolving, yeah.
Yeah, the evolving part is what's cool. And it's great to have what's in the, you know, these things that have lasted in the past. And we should do them. If you really want to be a curator of them, get musicians that aren't professional. Get the baker to play. Have them play something that is on cat gut string. They don't show up on time. Start the overture 45 minutes late. Sight read. You know, you know, have the candle lit,
yeah,
and put it in a house that, you know, have the conductor pounding a stick,
yeah,
to make sure they all play in time, mm-hmm, and have it be about, you know, 300 people in there talking until maybe something interesting happens.
And that will finally break down the class. We still have the class systems here.
Yeah,
too. That will start breaking things down.
You can see pavement stubs from Rossini where he got paid like 300 ducats for one of his new operas, and then his take from the casino that was in the opera house was like 1,500 ducats.
Oh my gosh.
Right? They had casinos, they had who knows what other things.
Yeah.
Of course, booze, drugs, and you got to have a beer. It was Vegas.
Yeah, Oruka. Right.
Yeah,
yeah,
it was Vegas.
Yeah.
So anyway, the people were people. Is, you know, back to the same theme as were the composers and the people that went to see this newest, latest, most modern sound that came out of them. And Rossini knew this too. That's why he makes fun of Bartolo singing that really boring thing when he calls the new music really stupid,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Wagner, the same thing, and Meistersinger. Oh, yeah, let's do something new, right? Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is that line between opera and musical theater, where is it? And you're saying it really doesn't matter.
I don't think it actually exists.
Thanks for listening to part one of our interview with Nathan Gunn. Austin, can you tell us what to expect in 2 weeks for part two?
So here's what's in the pipeline for part two. We talk with Nathan about developing your own voice, how to be unapologetically you. You can't really please everyone. And how Nathan's failures really shaped him as a singer, and how he views failures in a different perspective that might be really beneficial for you as you navigate your path as a vocalist.
Wonderful. Let's be on the lookout for that, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.